As most of you know, I'm substituting for John this morning, and the lecture he has listed will be given by him next week. This morning, we are going to become involved in an extremely difficult and sticky situation, and that is the gentle subject of money. And I don't know of any way to approach this philosophically in a more interesting manner than to go back to Egypt in ancient times. We're not sure that the monetary system originated in Egypt, but it was certainly functioning there 2 or 3,000 B.C. And because the Egyptians were a rather wise and interesting people, their opinions on this subject, while symbolical, I think is worthy of consideration. In Egypt, we are introduced to one of the earliest bankers. Now, in those days, they didn't call them bankers. They called them money changers. And this was a highly respectable occupation. In ancient times, most localities, cities, and countries had their own currencies. And when they traveled as citizens from one country to another, the individual had to change their money before they could spend it in a foreign country. So at the gate of the city was the money changer. He was seated behind a table or counter and had within his mind or in adequate notes the relative values of all currencies. And as the stranger came to the gate of the city, if he intended to spend money therein, he had to get the local currency. This was no great problem, and for the most part, the system worked very well. Occasionally, however, one of these money changers misbehaved. He could do several things. Many of those who came to him to exchange their coins did not know the prevailing rates for all the communities. And it's quite conceivable that occasionally the money changer shortchanged the customer. This was considered unethical, even at that time. And if a money changer was discovered to be dishonest, they took his table on which he had his various instruments and materials laid out and smashed it. Now, at that time, the table was called a bank. And it meant a table. The word bank means a table, primarily. And to break a table was to rupt it. So a dishonest dishonest money changer went bankrupt when his table was broken. And this is the origin of a term, and you can check it in the dictionary. It is still perfectly acceptable. Now, the money changer in himself was usually a good-natured soul. And for the most part, he was dominated by the religious teachings of the community in which he functioned. And so it happens that a philosophy dealing with this phase of life was developed at an early date. If a money changer was honorable, honest, and a little on the generous side, if possible, especially for the widow's mite and the coinage of the underprivileged, and the time came for him to die, he presented himself, or his soul was presented for him by the guardians of the gates of the other world, and he was taken into the hall of the great judgment, where the psychostasia ritual was performed, the judging of the souls of the dead. The judgment consisted of a court consisting of assessors or jurors, and this is the origin of our jury system in law. And it was presided over by Osiris, the god of the afterlife, and the judge of the quick and the dead. each applicant for admission into the afterlife was required to recite the negative confession of being. This negative confession has been declared to be one of the most astonishing documents in the history of mankind. And it is assumed that very few of those who appeared before the judge of the dead could possibly meet the requirements of this negative confession honestly. But as the jurors were there, and they were deities who could read the hearts and minds of men, the person under consideration had to be reasonably accurate. Now, among the 100 statements of the negative confession, the soul of the departed had to be able to say honestly that never in his life had he cheated any man. Now, that's a pretty big thing to say. He also had to say that without any question of doubt that he had been charitable, that he had helped the widow and the fatherless, and that he had used his position as money changer for the benefit of the community. He was permitted to make a small charge for the money changing, and that was all he was entitled to. Now, if he was reasonably innocent, he might well be allowed by the jurors to pass into the afterlife. If there were some doubts, but on the whole he was pretty good, then Horus, the beloved son of Osiris, interceded for the soul of the dead, saying that he would carry the punishment, or bear it, and the soul should be permitted to go into the afterlife. What happened to those who failed utterly is not part of the present story, but they met a proper and appropriate reward or penalty. Having entered into the afterlife, our honest money changer was then permitted to set up his table at the gate of heaven. And those who came in from all different directions had to change their money at his table, because the coinage of the mortal world was not accepted in the heavenly region. It was of no value over there, so it had to be transformed into a medium suitable to the life beyond the grave. I think this is a very ingenious thought. And of course, what did the individual bring with him? He couldn't bring the cash. That was obvious. What was the coin that he could carry into the afterlife and have it exchanged for a blissful existence? That coinage, of course, was his own merit. The only coin that was acceptable was his own conscience, his own integrity, and his own fitness. He had to be rewarded according to his works, and he had to receive a medium of exchange that it was acceptable in heaven. This, of course, gives us a very good symbolic idea. It was necessary that he have saved up his treasures for the other life. He had to come bearing the necessary symbols which entitled him to the reward which he had earned. So the transformation of the currency represented the rewarding of virtue and the changing of worldly wealth into its spiritual equivalent. This spiritual equivalent was his own character. It was his own merit, and sometimes his demerit. But if he was a good man and brought his proper coinage, he received the tokens of the other world, a world beyond the grave. And he was then allowed to go in and invest or expend his accumulated spiritual wealth for the comfort and continuance of his after-death state. Now, this is interesting because it tells us a lot about psychology. The individual who was the money changer continued to be a money changer. The fact he had passed on didn't put a halo on him, or crown him into the group of the celestials. He continued to live as he had lived in this world, but it was no longer a material world. It was that kind of world which the ancients considered to be a kind of sleep. A sleep. And as we learn in the soliloquy of Hamlet, in this sleep of death, what dreams may come shall give us pause. In other words, the whole thing was an internal experience. The money changer had his experience, if he was honest. He continued to do the things he was fitted to do. He continued to build his experiences from the previous life, and he would carry forward into the next life the merits and the internal spiritual experience and maturity which he had gained through honest dealing. This type of thought brings us very much into the psychological area, namely, that success and failure, wealth and poverty, justice, reward and penalty, are mysterious experiences of the inner life, the life which we all must face between embodiments, and our condition is determined by ourselves. When a farmer entered into the great Amentet, the Elysian fields of the blessed, he did not become a politician or a philosopher or a theologian. He was given a beautiful allotment of land. And here he was also given a spirit oxen to work the field. And he worked it with a plow. And the celestial Nile never failed to irrigate his land. And he became a happy and well-adjusted farmer, because that was what he was. Now, this does not mean that all life ends in farming. It means, however, that all life is a rewarding for accomplishment, and the individual being permitted by his own virtue to fulfill his own life constructively, beautifully, and unselfishly. This was the law of Egypt. This was the concept behind the development of a belief in the exchange of worldly goods. Now, on a more prosaic and more material level, we also know that the Egyptians had their own way of handling barter. Barter was the earliest form of exchange, and barter was the basis of our monetary system. In very ancient times, barter was an exchange of like for like, in value if not in commodity. If a man had a flock of sheep, and he wished to barter one or more of these sheep for something else that he needed or wanted, he went to the common market, and in many countries even today, barter is very largely the basis of all transactions. So he would drive a couple of sheep to town and exchange them for a cow or for clothing or for whatever he needed. Now, there's one point in this that's very important. In the barter system of that time, it was up to the original owner to protect the value of that which he hoped to exchange for something else. If the farmer, anxious to make a few extra dollars, did not feed his sheep, and they came scraggly and poor and thin into the market, he would get very little for them, because they were not kept up. And therefore, it was up to him to make sure that his collateral was in good condition. And if he took proper care of his own goods, then it could be exchanged for goods of equal quality. This placed a kind of censorship upon all transaction, because if the sheep was not properly cared for, it was simply not a serviceable instrument of exchange. When a wealthy Egyptian decided to buy something, he went to the shop where he could get what he wanted, and when the transaction was finished, he was given a little clay tablet, 2 or 3 inches square. Into this tablet, he impressed his signet ring. This signet ring was his bond. Now, the dealer who secured the signet stone had several possibilities. He could, of course, exchange it with some other dealer for something else he wanted. And the token became a medium of general exchange. If, however, he did not wish to barter it, he could take it to the house of the owner or the person who had given it to him. And at the door of the house was the steward, usually seated. The steward accepted the token and gave the merchant its equivalent in coinage or whatever he needed. There was never any question as to the integrity of the transaction. Somewhere in our collection upstairs, we have one of these token bills pressed upon clay. It was a sign of honest and proper transaction. And the person who received it had no doubt about it being redeemed, nor did anyone through whose hands it passed. It was known beyond doubt that the original man who put his seal upon it was honorable, honest, and capable of meeting the indebtedness. Thus we have a beginning of a medium of exchange. Gradually it became obvious that bringing sheep to market to change for something else was a rather complicated procedure. So it became necessary to develop some form of symbolic medium of exchange. Every nation of antiquity developed such types of material. There are coins that have come down to us that are cast in glass from very ancient dates. There are others that were cut into stone. Some were made into porcelain. And other various proper symbols, American Indian wampum, beadwork, the cori shell of the South Pacific. All of these were mediums of exchange. In early Virginia colony, a bundle of tobacco leaves was currency. All these different forms were intended to facilitate transactions. And when it became so complicated that no one could really bring all his produce to market himself, then it became very important that he have tokens by which he could claim payment or by which he could give payment. These tokens multiplied and became more and more complicated. But in every instance, the token served only one purpose. It stood for value. It represented a legitimate monetary or financial or commercial value. It was given as a symbol of an object. Now, for instance, you can say, we have what do we call today chattel mortgages. The word chattel, if you look it up, means cattle. And a chattel mortgage was an indebtedness placed upon a herd of animals. Of course, today it would be rather difficult and embarrassing to drive a herd of cows into a bank. But still in ancient times, always one thing was true. The token, whatever it was for value. And that value was fixed by the commodity patterns of the time. There was no escaping the simple fact that the token of itself had no value. The little lump of clay wasn't worth anything. The dollar bill cost to make it only a fraction of a cent. It has no value in itself. It is a symbol of value. Now, as long as it remained a symbol of value, we had a comparatively honorable state of exchanges. As long as this symbol was not expected to be a thing of value, but was only a symbol of a personal relationship, either through purchase or sale, as long as this continued, things were relatively honest. Gradually, however, a change took place. In this change, the commodity, the token, began to be regarded as valuable in itself. it was possible to accumulate these tokens, and by accumulation of them, to declare to others that we possessed a kind of wealth. When a knight in the Middle Ages got short of change, he took his armor or his helmet to the armorer, the man who made it, who would loan him a little money on it temporarily. This, again, was only a form of barter. The collateral was held against the payment of the debt. But the collateral had no value other than as a symbol of an ethical transaction. When the early Dutch in the end of Manhattan, south end of Manhattan Island, got together under a tree to form a benevolent association of mutual protection, it was the beginning of the stock exchange. That's how it all started. It was always a use of some convenient symbol by means of which transactions could be made more rapidly and more certainly and honorably. Gradually, the theory of accumulation took over. And of course, this theory of accumulation went head on into the Egyptian philosophy of life, namely, that whatever you accumulated could only be with you for the duration of your present existence. Some of the Druids of Britain are said to have borrowed money in one lifetime and guaranteed to pay it back in a later embodiment. This system, however, never became generally popular. But the theory was always the same, that we had to have some way of dealing with each other in the necessities of life. One man raised the corn, another man wove the goods. The cloth and the corn were values. The man who worked the corn changed it for yardage. This went on until finally we forgot the fact that the medium of exchange was a completely physical instrument. It had very little to do with anything except what it was intended to be, a way of handling a transaction. This gradually resulted in the concept that the coinage was something of eternal value, something that could be hoarded, something that could be passed on from one generation to another, and that finally, a superiority in this life was symbolized by coinage. Now, in old days, of course, coinage was not a symbol as it is to us. We look back upon the tales and legends of great wealth in antiquity. But most of this great wealth was in the hands of persons who had forgotten their own mortality. They had forgotten that they could not take it with them. They also learned, as they learned in Greece, that to pass it on to your descendants was one of the most dangerous procedures in the world, because in most cases it became a detriment upon the descendant. It prevented the descendant from going out and earning his own way. It prevented him from becoming a useful citizen, cooperating with others for the benefit of his society. He became an aristocrat simply because he accumulated little marks placed on tablets of clay or printed on the face of money. All this changed our psychology of life, and gradually, out of what we term the profit system, there has evolved the physical economic complexity which we know today. We have forgotten that we are not here primarily to accumulate. If we were going to live forever, it would be different. But in this foreverness of the higher world of things, the coinage cannot be considered immortal. It is part of a very simple procedure, a procedure of food, clothing, shelter, a procedure of guaranteeing the necessities of life by earning them, and by earning them to gain the tokens or symbols by which we could meet our responsibilities. In those days, there was no idea whatever of money making money. Money was to be used by the person who earned it to meet the requirements of his society and to carry himself rather than to become a dependent upon society. As we went along in this particular problem, another situation appeared almost immediately. And this is very intriguing. The moment a standardized form of currency came into existence, two things happened. Maybe both, or at least one of them. One was that this currency could be devaluated. The Roman emperors, when they got into financial trouble, instead of issuing silver coins, made their coins of copper and coated them with silver. It seems to me that happened around here not too long ago. Gradually, the coin no longer had a factual value. Now, as its moral and ethical value declined, its factual value became more obviously important in commerce. It became necessary that the coin itself be of some substance equal in value to the debt. The second thing that could happen and did happen frequently was that both the coinage and the currency or paper money was counterfeited. Now, counterfeiting began at a very early time. It became part of our way of life as soon as it became obvious that it was profitable. The earliest paper money that we have any record of was issued in China during the Ming Dynasty, around 1200 to 1300 AD. This paper money was about the size now of a typewriter sheet. It was marked with seals and various symbols of authority, and it contained its value stated in terms of strings of cash, pictures of strings of small money. On each of these notes appeared the statement that anyone guilty of counterfeiting one of these bills would be shortened by the length of one head. But needless to say, this was not discouraging. The counterfeiting continued and passed from one nation to another. Today, most coinage has been counterfeited somewhere because of it being profitable. It was a falsification. It was a definite act of dishonesty, but it was tolerated. The culprit was punished, but the process went on. So the paper money got to be in bad repute in China as early as the 14th century. And from there on to the establishment of the Republic by Dr. Sun Yat-sen, paper money was practically never circulated in China. No one trusted it because it was worth nothing in itself. You couldn't eat it. It even made a very small fire if you tried to burn it. It was of comparatively no value unless behind it was a staple system of financial integrities. In China also, coinage was variously adulterated. A shrewd Chinese would take a bag full of small silver coins and get one of his younger children to shake that bag by the hour. At the end of a certain length of time, the shaking caused little shavings of the silver to separate. He then washed the bag and cashed the profit. In China also, large silver coins were cut through horizontally, hollowed out, and sealed again. Within the last 50 years, the Chinese banks put purple stamps on dollars and other larger coins to prove that they had not been tampered with. Even in this country, many farming banks and small business would never give change for a silver dollar without dropping the dollar on a piece of marble set into the front of the cash register to hear it ring to make sure that it was genuine. So counterfeiting came in. And counterfeiting, however, was of no value and of no profit unless there was a genuine article. The counterfeit had to be based upon a value. And counterfeiting goes on, and in papers a few days ago, a counterfeiting ring was broken up. Thus, money began to get on all kinds of nasty appearances. Not because it had anything to do with the bill or the silver, but because of those evil ones who lay in wait for it. Someone asked Plato once why gold was such a pale metal. He answered, because it fears those who seek to possess it. The paleness is terror. Actually, the gradual development of the situation resulted in the rise of a great theory of money. This theory of money became the basis, practically, of human society. And within the last 50 years, the mistake has become obvious. We are finding ourselves captured in an economic problem which no one as yet seems to be able to solve. The problem of considering a medium of exchange as a capital gain in itself. Materialism, of course, has always nourished the concept of wealth. Now, wealth thoroughly and basically is considered in ancient times as a process in merit. Wealth was the individual reward for individual industry. Wealth was necessary to a measure, and it is still necessary to a measure. But wealth was actually an inducement to produce. It was an incentive to excel in some field of activity. This excellence might be in the making of a violin or in the development of some useful commodity. Actually, wealth in ancient times was closely associated with art and very closely associated with religion. It was a symbol of value, and this value was assumed to be a product of individual integrity. The individual was proving his ability through his own productivity. This productivity separated him from the indolent. The indolent person, the individual who had no concern for value, who wished to live without work, or wished to get by with as little labor and as large a profit as possible, must inevitably corrupt a system. He is not fulfilling his responsibility. Another rule of ancient Egyptian finance was that in the other life, the individual had to prove merit. He had to prove that his life had been in some way a contribution to public good. He had to have done something that was of service to others rather than himself. He had to have so lived that the world was a little bit better for the fact that he had lived. If his actions were such that the world was a little bit worse because he had lived, then he could not pass the final judgment. Today we are in a very complicated situation economically, and all the legislation in the world probably cannot solve it. It has to go back to where all responsibility in human affairs rests, and that is with the human being. The highest form of wealth, as Egypt pointed out, was integrity. This was the one commodity. Integrity involved both honesty and intelligence. The individual who is unhonest is making one serious mistake, and another person who is unintelligent in the use of what he has is making another mistake. His non-intelligence is contributing to the delinquency of other people. All of the principles involved are simple. The difficulty is to find an instrumentation for them. We have to find some method in this world by which principles are given an opportunity to guide human conduct. As time went on and goes on today, there has also been a great change in the attitudes of people toward life. Even in our younger days, life was a comparatively well-ordered existence. The individual belonged to a group. He might be a member of a guild. He might be a member of a trade union. He could well be a small shopkeeper or a small town physician. But he had his niche. He had his place where he worked, in the sense that he made his contribution to society. He lived within his means. It never occurred to him to live otherwise. And in spite of the fact that he might be surrounded by persons who had more than he had, this did not seriously discomfort him, because he did not regard wealth as a symbol of superiority. He knew enough from personal experience or observation to realize the miseries of the rich. He realized that they were not enjoying what they had. Instead of enjoying it, they were servants to it. And Buddha points this out very, very clearly. Namely, that those who do not have much live miserably because they do not have more. And that those who have much live in misery for fear that it shall be taken from them. And everyone shares a certain common anxiety. This was quite according to natural law and procedure. Now, when we come into the financial situation as it is, we realize that we have lost something. We have lost leadership. We have lost the guidance of the authority of principles. One of the principal factors in this situation has been materialism. Materialism has focused the mind entirely upon this small span of time, which we call a lifetime. Materialism has made it mandatory that success be achieved here, and that success here is the ultimate purpose of existence. In order to make this really stick, in order to be able to sell the idea on all levels of society, materialism must, in some way, interfere with the cultural morality of antiquity. The materialist must not look forward to any life beyond this one. He must realize that it is his privilege, as one of the Roman emperors is supposed to have said, to eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we shall die. Even the Romans were a little smarter, however, because whenever they had a great feast, they reserved one seat at the head of the table and placed a skeleton in it to remind all there that life was fleeting and that the inevitable was always close at hand. But in this problem, it's the concept of accumulation built around a materialistic attitude of life made it very valuable to some people to think in terms of material possessions. These material possessions might be a piece of land, a building, valuable personal properties. Whatever it was important. Yet we have no record up to the present time that any materialistic substance or possession can have a continuous effect upon consciousness. It must be left behind. Why then should we become so desperately dedicated to accumulations which at best are only loaned to us? We own nothing. We only own our own souls, and that we do not generally find sufficiently important to try to raise money on them. the materialistic position can only result ultimately in an overestimation of false values. If we are not aware of true values, then we substitute values that are not true and satisfy ourselves by the immediate accumulation of things rather than to contemplate the ultimate consequence. Now, this world is a very interesting place, and it has a great many dimensions that are worth a lot of thought. The human being can have a very interesting life, and also a life that is very profitable in terms of things he can take with him. Among the things that he can take with him, according to the Egyptians, are the attributes of his own soul. His soul power is his universal medium of exchange. It goes beyond anything that belongs to this world. Now, the power or treasuries or wealth of the soul are friendship, love, thoughtfulness, dedication, the improvement of the mind and heart, the accumulation of wisdom, and the practice of charity. These are soul values, and when the Egyptian jurors weighed the soul of the dead, these are the things that they estimated. What has the individual done that makes it proper for him to expect a better future? That he will go on to be what he was intended to be. Now, when we get started on the problem of our material existence and begin to estimate how much we can do with this small ball floating in space that we call the Earth, we kind of take on the attitude that in some way or other, this little ball is going to sustain our concept of wealth. We want to investigate this little ball very carefully, but we do not investigate it to find out what it means in a cosmic plan of things. We measure it in order to determine how many mortgages we can put on it. It becomes a problem of using the earth as collateral. And as a collateral, we are getting into some trouble. We like to think, perhaps, of this planet as a little like a bottle, an alchemical retort, a round, transparent bottle. And in this bottle are all kinds of hidden treasures. Everything under the surface of the earth is filled with all kinds of potential sources of good. Even the moisture that causes the plant to break through the surface is part of the evidence of an eternal life in the earth. But if, for instance, instead of nurturing this, working with it, struggling to preserve and protect it, using the earth with a sense of responsibility to the creating power, if instead of this all we do is exploit the earth, there is a compensation which we do not like. For instance, we are going to be faced more and more with a petroleum problem. And we are going to fight and struggle and buy and sell and trade and swap and steal to control the available fuel resources.